This is Clay from Skilled Gentlemen Podcast. You're listening to Handgun World Podcast with Bob Main.
Hi, folks. Bob Main here with another episode of the Handgun World Podcast. I carry a gun because I can't carry a cop. Welcome to a rebroadcast, actually. I'm going to rebroadcast episode 119 that I recorded back in April of 2011. As I've mentioned recently, probably once or maybe twice, but usually once a month, I am going to rebroadcast some of the older shows that I've done. Why? Well, first of all, people have asked how can they access older shows, because if you use iTunes or Stitcher Radio or most of the podcast catchers out there, most of them don't go back all the way to the beginning of my shows. I've been doing this over 6 years and, 365-something episodes or something like that. So that's one reason. The other is, you know, there's an old saying, the old is forever new. And, you know, 5 years is not that old. And sometimes some of the things that were talked about 5 years ago are still very relevant. And it serves as a good reminder. And that's one of the another reason why I'm going ahead and putting up an interview from back in April of 2011. I don't know how many of you listen to the Power Factor show, but I would strongly recommend it. This rebroadcast is Steve and Rick from the Power Factor show. I had them on several times. This is kind of a cool discussion because we talked about a various amount of topics. We talked about training. We talked about concealed carry. We talked a little bit about competition shooting. We talked about being a good instructor and what makes a good instructor and things. All kinds of really cool subjects like that. So before I get into the interview, I want to say don't forget about my sponsor, my one and only sponsor, Concealment Solutions. And, you know, Jason makes some fine, fine holsters. There are a lot of good holster makers out there. I use Concealment Solutions about 85 or 90% of the time when I'm carrying. And I have really come to like the outside the waistband Cobra holsters. Very, very concealable. Matter of fact, I think in many ways it's just as concealable as wearing an inside the waistband holster. But you're carrying outside the waistband, so it increases comfort. And Jason's quick detach clips are great. The holster stays on the belt. It avoids that problem. Very good Kydex holsters. Of course, his Black Mamba series are very popular. And the ASP, the appendix-specific platform holsters, for those of you that like to carry appendix like I do as well. So check them out, ConcealmentSolutions.com. Do me a favor, folks. If you buy something from ConcealmentSolutions.com and you hear it on this show, please use the coupon code HANDGUNWORLD. It gets you 10% off of everything except belts. HANDGUNWORLD is the coupon code, and that tells Concealment Solutions that you're one of my listeners and that I am sending traffic their way. Okay, let's get to Steve, Zofie, and Rick Brenneman from the Power Factor show in April of 2011. Enjoy.
Good afternoon. This is your captain speaking with just a little flight information. Coming up on the left, we're going to be catching a glimpse of the Grand Canyon. On the right, you can be able to see the Hoover Dam in just a few minutes. We're flying at an altitude of 37,000 feet, and our airspeed is 400 miles an hour. Couple little facts here. I'm packing a Colt King Cobra. That's a 357 caliber firearm with a black rubber grip and a 6-inch barrel. Also, the co-pilot is carrying a Kimber custom defense pistol with all the bells and whistles you'd expect from a custom gun of that kind, with an alloy frame and bevel treatment on the entire gun. And our chief flight attendant, Roger, has a Ruger Bearcat 22 with a hand-fluted cylinder. All three are capable of piercing body armor at a distance of up to 27 feet, and it can put a hole in human bone and flesh the size of the Grand Canyon, which, by the way, is coming up on the left-hand side of the plane, so just sit back and relax and enjoy the rest of the flight.
Okay, for the main topic, I got two people. I have Steve and Rick from the Power Factor show. How are you guys doing?
Good, Bob.
Great. Glad to be here.
Yeah. This, you know, don't you love technology? I mean, this is good stuff here.
It's better than a telephone that can tell me what the music is playing on the radio.
And, and one of these days, Rick will get with the program and actually have a phone that does more than just make phone calls.
Yeah.
No, sometimes I wish I just had a phone that makes phone calls.
And then you're Rick's best buddy then.
Yeah, sometimes this email on a phone and web browsers on a phone here, you know, for the technically challenged people like me, sometimes I wish this was still like about 1993.
Yeah, I think I'm stuck in about 1993.
Remember, you know, since we're on this subject here, before we get into guns, remember those bag phones?
No. The bag phones?
Yeah, the very first cell phones we had. Well,
they were
actually,
bricks. They were called
well,
brick phones.
You carry
yeah.
the bag because it was so big.
Well, we had bag phones too. Don't you remember that? Where the phone would actually sit in a bag that had a shoulder strap that you could carry over your shoulder.
Right. The first ones that I actually had one of, well, not the first one, but I guess when you say the second one, but the first cell phones that I know of were literally in a briefcase. And then the next ones were the Motorola, I don't know what, and they called them brick phones because they literally looked like a brick. I mean, they were literally about that size. So yeah, I actually had one of the very early, early cell phones. And Rick will probably say, of course you did, Steve, right about this
time.
Yeah.
I didn't get my first cell phone until about 2008. So.
And you're still using, I thought you were going to say you're calling in on a bag phone, Rick.
No, not this time.
All right. Well, I brought these guys on the show to talk a little bit about training and being an instructor, since people have been putting that on the GRRN forum about me, something I just don't see myself doing right now because I don't have much time. But both of you guys are instructors, aren't you?
Steve?
Well, I'm not an official instructor in terms of NRA recognition. Rick, you're an instructor. You have two classifications. Is that correct?
Actually, three NRA certifications.
Okay.
As well as being IDPA safety officer instructor.
And what are the three classifications that you have in terms of NRA?
I knew you were going to ask me that. It's basic pistol. I think it's called firearm safety in the home and personal protection. I think are the names of the three classes.
Okay.
And then you said you're an IDPA safety officer instructor,
safety
right?
Officer instructor as well, yes.
And then, Steve, you're an IPSC 101 instructor, aren't you?
Yeah, both Rick and myself and one of our shooting buddies have been teaching what we call IPSC 101, which is a introduction to IPSC class that takes either experienced or inexperienced shooters through a two-day class, literally starting at the very beginning of just terms of rules, safety, going through dry fire exercises, live fire exercises, shooting mini courses of fire, and then taking them through their very first match. So there's no real official certification for anything like that, but we've been doing it for the last 4 years. The primary reason that we kind of got into doing this is that Rick and I really entered into IPSC literally the same way through the same class, however, albeit I think at different times. I think I took mine in 1992. And Rick, when did you do yours?
It must have been in the spring of 97, because that's when I shot my first match.
Okay. But we both took literally the same class at different times. And from the standpoint of our local section here, you know, there's I think one of the concerns from a lot of people in terms of getting involved in competition is that they're kind of nervous or really hesitant that they want somebody to kind of show them the way or hold their hand initially through the very first match or the very first couple matches or something like that.
Yeah.
And I think that's the kind of the attraction of the class we do, is that we're literally, you know, taking shooters and pairing them up with very experienced shooters and not only showing them the proper technique, but literally how to shoot stages, how to shoot a match, how to compete, how to do everything. And I think it kind of gets them over the hurdle, so to speak. We've had fairly good traction in terms of, people who have stuck with it. I mean, it's around 30 or 40%. That doesn't really sound like a very high number when you think about it.
Mm-hmm.
But I think what happens is that we've seen in a lot of our classes that we'll get people who are not really so much interested in competition, but really more so interested in just general, technique, principles, practice, whatnot, and know that pretty much competition shooters are at the top of the game and probably know more about, you know, the better techniques and than your average, you know, shooter off the street or whatever. And I think that's the attraction for a lot of them to come to the class. And then you don't see them again. So.
Yeah. Well, you know, and I think this is cool. And so one of the first questions that came to my mind is there's a lot of people that I, you know, probably say, hey, I would love to be an instructor. I think I could do that. And some have posted on the forum and some probably not. Maybe the thought's gone through their mind. What would you guys tell somebody that is experienced, has a certain expertise when it comes to shooting and firearms? What would you tell them to start doing to start teaching people?
Well, I think that it's important that they have some ability as an instructor. I mean, whether it's firearms or, you know, teaching people how to use their cell phone. Because I know when I started doing the safety officer instructor classes, I'd never really done any instructing. I mean, I was somewhat familiar with standing in front of a room and making a presentation, but I mean, I sat through a kind of audited a safety officer class taught by a couple of other guys, and these guys are experienced presenters. They do it on a daily basis at work. They're familiar with PowerPoint presentations and whatnot, and I was just amazed at how smoothly they did it. I mean, it was just seamless the way they went through it, and I just thought, they're presenting exactly the same material that I do, and we've done the class about an equal number of times, but I was just really impressed with their ability to instruct, you know, kind of regardless of the topic.
You know, Rick, you hit on something important there, because a lot of people know how to shoot very well, but they can't teach it because they're not very good presenters.
Yeah, oh, very much so. I mean, I think it's interesting. You see, today especially, and I think it's driven a lot by the large numbers of ex-military that have combat experience and are trying to translate that into the civilian sector by becoming firearms instructors. And a lot of guys are hanging shingles out and advertising as instructors. But, boy, just because you have experience doing doesn't mean you're a good teacher. It doesn't mean it translates into the ability to teach somebody else how to do it.
Yeah, I think that's why people have made mention of me at times. You know, I've got a lot of presentation experience just because of what I do. But, yeah, I tell you what, though, I've tried a couple of times showing people some basic stuff about shooting, and I don't think I did very well, even though I can present some material and I can present ideas and thoughts because that's what I do for a living. I don't know. There's something about when I actually get a gun in my hand and stand next to somebody with a gun in their hand. It just seems to be a little difficult for me. I don't know.
I think what a lot of it comes down to is communication skills. I mean, the ability to, you know, to translate what you're thinking or what you know or knowledge. A lot of personal skill, just the ability to, you know, to relate to people and understand their questions and listen. I think those are two very key things, but I think also a lot of it gets down to being patient. I mean, you'll get a lot of people who, you know, if you're an impatient instructor and somebody's not doing something the way you want it to, or would like them to, or whatever, you know, you need to stick with them and keep working through it until, you know, you're seeing the results that you're looking for. I think a lot of times people will see something in terms of instruction and go, well, that guy's not getting it and he's never going to get it, so we're just going to move on to the next one. And that's something that you really got to look out for.
You know, Steve, good point. And patience is not one of my strong suits. I mean, you know, I'm glad that most of the time I get to do the podcast myself because I can, you know, all I have to worry about is just me. I don't have to worry about someone else trying to get it. I figure if you guys don't get what I'm saying, you can rewind it as many times as you want and just keep playing it over and over again.
Right, right.
But in a live situation, when you're trying to teach someone how to shoot, it gets a little frustrating. What do you think, Rick?
Well, yeah. I mean, in the part that I think I'm the least comfortable with is trying to determine why somebody isn't doing it as well as I think they should after I've given them my expert instruction, you know. I mean, I'll stand there and explain sight alignment and trigger control and demonstrate it, and then when they don't do it correctly, then it's a matter of, okay, we've got to analyze what is it they're doing wrong. And there are so many, I mean, it's just, you know, I've actually seen this chart that somebody makes that shows, you know, well, if the bullets are tending this direction on the target when they shoot, that means they're pulling it with their finger. And if they're trending this way, that means they're flinching. And if they're trending it this way, that means they're, you know, it's like all these different little nuances of trying to correct these little errors in shooting. And I find it that's the hardest part, is that kind of diagnosing what the actual problem is, to get to the root of why it's not turning out as strictly as a firearms instructor. I mean, trying to teach somebody to shoot, that's what I find to be the most, I don't want to say frustrating, but just kind of the part that gives me the most trouble as an instructor.
Yeah, so for people that want to do it, people that want to teach others to shoot, we're talking here, we've identified so far, you got to have patience, you have to be able to diagnose and try to figure out, okay, you know, did I just not get my point across, or are they not grasping the concept?
Yeah, because, you know, I mean, part of it is understanding, and then part of it is execution. And somebody who understands it perfectly still isn't necessarily going to do it right. And then you can have somebody, I mean, there are some people who are just, you know, kind of naturals. I mean, I've watched some girls that I knew trap shooting. I mean, they'd never fired a weapon before in their lives, and they're holding them like they're, not like it's a weapon, but they're breaking more clays than I was, and I'd shot it a number of times. I mean, it's like, we're going to take those gals up and teach them how to shoot, kind of a deal, and I'm like, there's nothing I could teach them. They just were able to do it right off the bat.
Yeah, you know, and that's a good point. Now, Steve, okay, when you do an IPSC 101 class, what do you start with?
We start at the very bottom. We start with safety. It's all, you know, the one thing about IPSC is it's all about safety. So we go over Cooper's four safety rules, and then we get into a lot of the safety rules that USPSA has in terms of shooter safety and infractions and things of that nature, which just Rick loves that section of the class, to be honest. But at any rate, and then we go into a discussion about target scoring, and the reason we bring target scoring up at that point is so that they know where the center of the target is and what the highest scoring area is, because the next step after that is going through and doing draw, grip, and stance. And the key thing there is that they need to know what to look at, or what part of the target to look at, when they do their draw. So that's the reason why we do it in that order. And then we go through a whole pile of dry fire exercises, and then move into live fire exercises. But really, to answer your question directly, it really starts out as a safety discussion.
How long is the course?
The first day is roughly 7 hours, I believe, of instruction, followed by the second day, which is personalized coaching through their first match, which is going to be your typical IPSC match of six stages or so. And typically what we do is, for the first, say, three or four of the six stages, we give them really personalized instruction of how they should do things, where they should reload, how they should engage targets, different ways to dissect a stage, movement into ports, how to deal with everything. And then for about the last two or three stages, we kind of take the training wheels off and let them kind of figure it out on their own, so that they really have that ability to learn how to break a stage down on their own after we've kind of shown them how to do it. So the second day is roughly, I don't know, 6 or 7 hours worth of time also. So you're looking at roughly 14 hours, give or take, of instruction.
Cool. And Rick, when you do the safety officer training, tell us about that.
It consists of about an 8 or 9 hour classroom session. Every time I've taught the class or been involved in teaching the class, we do the vast majority of the classroom work in one day, one long day. And then we come back to the range in the morning and do some live fire exercises that just involve, generally one of the instructors will act as the problem child who, you know, doesn't know to wait until they've been instructed to draw their gun. You know, they're wandering around further downrange than they should while another shooter is shooting. And so we're just kind of trying to get the instructor candidates up to speed on what they can expect to see at a match in terms of behavior and misbehavior, and not like unsportsmanlike conduct misbehavior, but just, people who aren't paying attention or aren't listening to them, and trying to, you know, just get them up to speed with. And a lot of it really is just what I call that kind of command presence. Just, you know, you are in charge, and you have to present yourself as the person who's running the show. You can't be intimidated, and so it's just a lot of book learning initially, but then the second half day at the range is, you know, just putting it into practice.
You know, it's an interesting thing that Rick brings that up is that, and both he and I have done this, but in terms of USPSA, there's something called the NROI, which is the National Range Officer Institute. And Rick and I have both been through the Range Officer course, which is a 2-day class. And then I've been through the Chief Range Officer course, which is, well, was done by correspondence, but at any rate, but the Range Officer course is very similar to what Rick's talking about, is that the first day is literally going through the rule book and different scenarios and whatnot, to really kind of push you as a range officer of things that you might run into. And they've got a whole can set of just bizarre, weird situations that, you know, people, as in the shooter, the mock shooter in this situation, can do or could do or whatever. And then the second day is going out to, typically to the range and effectively shooting or doing a mini course of fire where everybody pretend or actually acting as the range officer running the shooter and whatnot. And every once in a while, somebody being a shooter will intentionally go and do something to just put the RO out of their comfort zone, just to see how they react to it. So there's that aspect also that both Rick and I have been through in terms of training as the NROI training course.
That's cool. So you guys have been through a lot of training. And I mean, that's, I think that's neat. You know, you guys have been through probably more training than some people ever go through in their entire life when they're handling guns.
From the competition aspect, yeah. I mean, I've been, like I said before, I've been to a couple of defensive classes. I think, Rick, you've been to a defensive class or two, haven't you?
No, I did go to a school, but it was for a match. It was a tactical match, so it was a different kind of experience. It was a learning experience, but it wasn't intended specifically as instruction.
Hey, Steve, that brings up a question. Your training that you've had in competition and the teaching that you do, preparing people to learn how to compete, did it help you in your tactical match or self-defense match?
From the standpoint of just becoming a more proficient shooter, definitely, yes. I mean, that's what we've said all before in the past is that, you know, competition is there to help you become more familiar with the gun, improve your shooting technique, improve your reloading technique, the ability to shoot in the move, shooting in strange different positions and things of that nature. So from that standpoint, definitely, yes. But again, you know, defensive scenarios and competition scenarios are very different from each other. The only, I think, relationship between the two is that you're shooting a gun and you've got to align the sights on the target and press the trigger and perform proper reloads when necessary.
Yeah. Rick, so, you know, how come you're not doing NRA courses?
Well, it's kind of, it's a couple of things. One, somebody kind of talked me into taking the classes. It was over a holiday weekend. So we became, at the class, which I think had, there's probably at least 50 people in it, became certified in three different disciplines all in one weekend. Mm-hmm. And so I was at the range for probably 8 hours a day or more, 3 days in a row, to get the certification. And it was one of those deals where somebody said, hey, I'm going to go do this. You want to go? And I said, well, okay, I don't have anything else to do. And then the person that convinced me to go dropped out after the first day because it was just too much of a time commitment, and I just thought, well, I've been through one day, I might as well stick with it, so I get my certification. And then there are like training kind of directors. It's my impression is that they're regional around the country, and so I contacted my regional director and said, hey, you know, I'm ready to go, I'm certified, you know, where do you need me, kind of a thing. And I never heard back. And I was busy enough with other things. I mean, I was helping run an IPSC club and shooting every weekend already as a competitor.
Yeah.
And I just, you know, just kind of fell off my radar a little bit, and just I have put it to use. I've taught people how to shoot, but I've just never actually conducted the NRA classes as they're written with using the class materials. I've used the knowledge that I gained in the classes to teach people how to shoot, but I've just never done the formal class setting.
You know, I want to get you guys to give me your 2 cents on this. I was reading on a forum probably about a month ago, somebody that was in your shoes, Rick, that had 3 or 4 different NRA certifications, and he did it with the intent to be an instructor and make money with it. And he put a good post on the forum. He said, you know, you can get all the certifications in the world, but if you don't know how to promote yourself, you're never going to make any money.
Yeah, and I never looked at it that way. I mean, I never thought of it as a business opportunity. I thought of it more along the lines of kind of like an adjunct to the competition stuff that I was already doing as a range officer, and you know, it would help me, but it would then also help me if I did get into a situation. I mean, I have to admit that a lot of the time I'm looking at things that I can do now that might help in the future. And so, for instance, mm-hmm. you know, I'm now a safety officer instructor, but I got my NRA certifications, you know, a few years prior. So I already had this sense of, okay, I know how to organize a presentation. I know, you know, how to stand in front of a class and stuff. So each step of the way, it's benefited me, but I just haven't been able to turn it into a business, something that I do on the side, you know, to, like teach classes. I've thought about it. I mean, it's one of those deals where I'll go to a range, an indoor range, and I'll say, hey, you know, Monday night is NRA basic pistol class, you know, $75 per student with a maximum of 10 students. And, mm-hmm. you know, easily I can do the math and think, boy, you know, if I did one of those a month, okay, then it's okay. Where do I find range facilities? You know, where, you know, and I just, it just kind of, it's one of those things where I'm thinking, you know, someday when I'm retired, I'll retire near a shooting range and become the NRA instructor there to make enough money to pay for my ammo or something, you know.
Well, yeah, you have to be able to promote. You have to be able to find range time and be able to get it at a reasonable price, I guess.
Yeah,
and,
exactly.
You know, all those things have to come together, plus your certifications and your knowledge.
But I think that gets into really what you personally are looking for as becoming an instructor. I mean, are you in it to, you know, financially gain from it, or are you in it to educate people and bring more people into the shooting sport and, you know, that aspect? It's an important question, I think, that you need to ask yourself of why you're doing this. If you're doing this simply from the financial standpoint, then you need to look at it from that standpoint of, promotion and things of that nature. But if you're looking at it just simply from the standpoint of, hey, I want to get more people involved in the shooting sport, I'm not in this thing to make a buck, I want to educate people, you know, your focus is obviously going to change, and how you're going to go about promoting the class to a certain degree will also change too.
You know, good point. I will bet, and I'll probably hear from some firearms instructors if I'm not correct about this. I would bet that the vast majority of them start because they love it, because it's a passion, it's a hobby, it's something that they love to do, and it just evolves, and they get successful at it, and they get known, and people start wanting to take their training, and then it becomes a business later on.
That very well could be the case. I mean, I know in terms of our IPSC 101 classes, the main reason from our standpoint of doing the classes is not for financial gain or anything like that, but literally to bring more people into the sport and expose more people to IPSC shooting. And it's funny because we've had past students then bring in some of their buddies, and they bring in their buddies, and it just kind of like, you know, cascades from there. But I think over the last, we try to keep our classes really small, about 10 people per class. So we've introduced, I think, roughly around 100 people or so over the last 4 years, new people into shooting. And again, you know, not all of them have stuck around. Mm-hmm. But the people who have stuck around have brought their friends into the game, you know, directly or indirectly, one way or another. And that, to me, is at least the personal enjoyment of just bringing more people into the sport that we love.
Have either of you guys thought about being a concealed carry instructor?
I have thought, living here in Washington State, which is a shall-issue state, if you fulfill the paperwork requirements for a concealed carry permit, the state will issue you the permit. But I've lived in a state where you must attend some sort of a training class, sometimes many, many hours of training before you can get a concealed carry permit. And so I have very definitely thought in terms of, as I'm collecting various certifications and whatnot, would that stand me in good stead if in the future either that kind of training was required in Washington State, or if I moved to a state that had a requirement, I would like to position myself to be one of those instructors.
I guess I messed up. I didn't know that Washington did not require you to take a certain amount of hours of training.
Nope.
No.
I got my form. fill out the form. They do a background investigation, fingerprint you, and as long as they don't turn up any felony convictions or, I think, involuntary mental institution confinement kind of things, you get the permit.
Oh, I didn't know that. Texas requires, I think it's 8 to 10 hours.
Yeah, when I lived in Massachusetts, it was like a 3-month, $400 endeavor where they called up all my former employers, former roommates.
Old girlfriends?
I had to go to the range and shoot.
I'm surprised you could even get one in Massachusetts.
Yeah, I know. I was
kind of funny. Yeah,
Massachusetts is a... I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I was going to say I had to get a driver's license because I was a Washington State resident still. So I got a Massachusetts driver's license. Then you have to get what they call, I think, a firearms permit, which is just like a firearms ID.
Yeah.
Then you go down and start the application process. And one of the things is in order to get the permit, you have to already belong to a gun club. I'm going, well, if I don't have the permit, why would I belong to a club? And so I used range time at a local range where I wasn't actually a member, but I got the guy who ran the range to sign a paper that said, yeah, he's a regular here and he's a good guy. And they try to make it as inconvenient as possible. I mean, they would call me down there and I'd spend an hour sitting there talking to these detectives or whatever they were, and then they'd send me home, and then 2 or 3 weeks later they said, well, you got to come down for another hour and we're going to discuss this aspect of it. And then another month would go by, and then they'd call me down again, and, you know, and it was just kind of a, I think they literally tried to make it as onerous as possible so that people just wouldn't bother.
Did you finally get a Massachusetts permit?
I did, yeah. And the thing that was kind of interesting is they have two permits. There's the permit that allows you to transport your gun from your home or your business to the gun club and back to your home or business. And that one is not what we're familiar with in Washington as a concealed carry permit, where you're allowed to essentially carry a gun wherever you're legally allowed to be. Unless there's some law that specifically, you know, says you can't come in here. In
right.
Massachusetts, you have the one permit that's just essentially for gun club members who are transporting their gun to and from their house. Then you have a second permit that is more like the self-protection-oriented permit that allows you to carry wherever you're going. But to a large extent, the only people who get those permits are people who handle a lot of money. So, like, if you own a jewelry store, you can get one of those permits. And I always liken it to the taxes are so high in Massachusetts, they want to make sure the people who are paying the taxes can get the permit because they don't want to cut off their revenue stream. the poor schmuck like me, you know, who just wants to go to the range, he doesn't raid.
Okay, well, wait a minute. Now, I know we're a little off topic, but that's okay because this is good stuff. So do you mean they made you get a permit to carry your unloaded gun from your home to the gun club?
Boy, I don't remember if there was a requirement that it be unloaded or not. I just know it was one of those deals where, I mean, it literally was from your house to the gun club. If you took a detour off the beaten path and visited your aunt, the permit was no longer valid. It was only
joke.
Good literally between your house and the gun club.
So hey Rick, when were you in Massachusetts, and did you compete when you were there? When you were shooting IFSC then at that time?
I was there in the late 80s, early 90s.
Oh, okay.
And this was before I shot IFSC, but I was going to the range. There were only 2 or 3 public ranges in the entire state of Massachusetts. And we would drive up almost all the way, I think it was to the New Hampshire border. There was a gun range right there on the border. It was a hour or more away from where I lived, and I'd drive up there with my roommate every week or two and just shoot on an indoor range up there.
Wow. So, you know, I mean, all the people like me that live in all these gun-friendly states that, and like you guys up there that issue licenses, I guess we kind of take this stuff for granted, don't we?
Yeah. And in Washington, it's kind of interesting. I mean, Washington has a reputation amongst the other western states as being fairly restrictive because we just recently had a law, our legislature passed the law that will allow us to actually attach the silencers that we own to our weapons. And, but we're...
The reason why that's a joke is because you were allowed to have a suppressor, but you weren't allowed to attach it to anything up until recently.
So it was a conversation piece when you're drinking, when Rick brings the Jägermeister out of the fridge,
right.
he can talk about his suppressor.
Exactly.
But he just couldn't attach it to a firearm, yeah.
Yeah. I don't have them in the same room at the same time. But we were, for many, many years, Washington was one of the few states west of the Mississippi River that banned the possession of machine guns. And in the entire, what I consider kind of western United States, Montana, Wyoming, you know, California, Nevada, Arizona, Oregon, Idaho, of those states, except, I'm not sure about California anymore, but Washington is the only one in which you cannot own a machine gun. And so a lot of Washington shooters, if they're traveling to a match or just traveling out of town, going to the, you know, any of those western states, going to a gun club and renting a machine gun is a big deal. I always try to do it because we can't own them here.
Wow, interesting. You know, so in Washington, let me get this straight. As long as you fill out the proper paperwork, pay the fee, pass the background check, and if you're not as nutty as Charlie Sheen, they'll give you a permit.
Yes, a concealed, it used to be called a concealed pistol license.
Okay.
I don't think it's good for, you know, a blackjack or a knife or anything. It's the CPL, and it's only good for carrying a pistol as far as I remember.
Okay.
But, yeah, they're very liberal about that. I mean, I hate to use the word liberal. They're really conservative about it in the sense that they're very liberal about distributing them. They don't make you jump through a lot of hoops to get the concealed pistol license, but then they're very restrictive in other ways. And the city of Seattle is always leading the charge for being restrictive, but because we have state preemption that prevents any city or local municipality from passing laws that are different from state law, the city of Seattle hasn't made much headway in trying to ban guns in parks, ban guns in restaurants, ban guns in, you know, street corners. You know, even when the city attorney says, you know, that's not going to pass muster, they try to do it anyway. So it's just
definitely tried, but the state Supreme Court has knocked them down every time.
So, Steve, here's a question for you. Well, for both of you guys, but Steve, you start. You know, I've caught some heat for saying this. I've had people email me and kind of needle me a little bit about this. But as much as I am a believer that everybody should have the right to conceal carry, I'm also a believer. I think training should be required. And I've had people say, oh, no, that's the Second Amendment doesn't say we have to have training. And I know that the Second Amendment doesn't say we have to have training. But since you guys are both instructors, how do you feel about that?
I don't think training should be required.
Okay.
I mean, basically, I was just going to say that from my standpoint, it's the Second Amendment, and it is what it is. I highly encourage anybody who does carry or does shoot, go out and seek training, become more proficient, but it is not a prerequisite to being able to conceal carry, in my mind. Never should be.
So do you think that the states like Texas, where I am, and many, many others that force you to get training, are they wrong?
In my mind, I would say yes.
Okay. What do you think, Rick?
I think having it mandatory is consistent with the Constitution, but I think the states can encourage people to get training. For instance, in the state of Washington during the there was a period of time where there was a 5-day waiting period when you bought a handgun. But
yeah.
If you had a concealed pistol license, the 5-day waiting period was waived. So it was like an incentive for you to have the concealed license because you got a benefit from it. So, if, for instance, if they had a similar situation where you know, you got some benefit if you had the training, then you would do it and everybody would benefit. You'd get the training. The state would have people that are trained, but they wouldn't have to force it on you. You'd get something for instance, I mean, you know, you have to fill out the federal paperwork and have the NICS check done whenever you buy a gun.
Right.
And now, I think as we discussed on a prior episode, in the state of Washington, if you buy a gun, you have to pay sales tax on it, even if you didn't buy it in Washington. The person who does the sales transfer, the FFL holder, collects the sales tax.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what if the state says, if you take the training and get a CPL, we'll waive the sales tax on gun purchases?
There's a benefit.
That would be a serious incentive.
You have an incentive. Yeah, well, that's a bad example because, of course, our legislature and our governor are very much like the ones that they usually have in Massachusetts. So,
tax them until they drop, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Well, you know, Rick, we sort of have a benefit like that here in Texas. If you buy a gun in the state of Texas, if you are a CHL, we call them concealed handgun license, if you're a CHL holder, you skip the NICS background check completely and just pay for your gun, fill out the form, and walk out of the store with it.
You sure. skip the NICS entirely? They still don't call up and verify
nope.
you?
Nope. Really? Nope, not if you have a CHL. Well, they figure, hey, you had to go through the NICS to get the CHL, you're good.
That's true. Yeah. Up here, though, I mean, like Rick was pointing out, is that at the very least what they do is, I mean, you can walk in, show them your concealed weapons permit. They'll still run, I mean, they still call in the 4473 and run the NICS check on you, and assuming that you pass all that and everything, which you should. But at any rate, they'll turn the gun over to you and let you go.
No, they don't have to run that check here in Texas if you have a valid CHL. See, here they feel if you have a valid CHL, you're one of the good guys.
Right, yeah.
Exactly.
So they feel like they don't need to check up on you because you're one of the good guys, and you had to be a good guy to get the CHL in the first place.
Well, Washington is still more anti-gun than Texas is, so that probably kind of shows you the reason. I mean, obviously, you guys can own full auto down there, correct?
If you have a Class 3 license.
Right. I mean, but you're allowed as a citizen, if you have a Class 3 license, to own and possess a full auto weapon.
Yes, I believe that's the case, yes.
Which we don't. So, yeah, I mean, there's still a lot of backwards laws up here going on in Washington State, and probably this, like your comparison of the NICS check of you guys don't, we do, so on, is probably still indicative of the anti-gun nature up here.
Well, so Steve, here's a training question for you. Back to the training issue for a minute. Okay, earlier you said you don't think that the training should be required for someone to get their concealed pistol license.
Mm-hmm.
Have you ever had anybody show up for one of your IPSC 101 classes that was just blatantly unsafe with a gun?
We had one guy out of, I would say, 100. Rick knows where I'm going with this.
Rick's laughing.
At first, I thought it was just the guy was just jittery, but he was just the whole entire competition thing. And we were even before we went to the match phase, but just the general shooting, he was just shaking like a leaf. And I thought, okay, well, maybe he's just got, you know, some sort of condition. I don't want to start asking personal questions or anything like that. And when we shot the match, I mean, he calmed down a little bit. But he just still seemed rather jittery, for the lack of a better term, and we cleared him. And I still, to this day, don't have any concern or reservation about clearing him. And we do have the discretion. In fact, we have not cleared people before just because of issues. But at any rate, we cleared him, and he came up and said, you know, I just don't feel comfortable shooting another match on my own. So, yeah, I mean, I guess I would say that, yes, we have seen people that do make us a little bit nervous, but a lot of the beginning shooters that we've seen and just general gun handling stuff and everything make us a little bit nervous, because all of a sudden, and you and I have had this discussion before, where, you know, you throw people into competition shooting and they get the feeling that everybody's watching them and looking at them, and in reality, probably nobody's looking at them.
Right.
But this is kind of like, you know, the performance on a stage type of deal, where it just kind of unnerves people. And I think that pushes them well out of their comfort zone, as opposed to when they're just, you know, on what we refer to as a square range, where they're shooting and definitely nobody's looking at them. So from that aspect, I think it can really kind of, you know, screw people up and push them into a sort of a nervous state or an uncomfortable state to begin with.
But when the guy showed up, was he being blatantly unsafe?
No, I would not say he was unsafe. He just seemed like he was really shaking. And I thought he was just like really tense, or he had, you know, some, you know, neurophysical issues or whatever. But no, he was not, in my mind, unsafe or anything of that nature. Now,
okay.
Rick, do you know who I'm talking about? And do you have any comments on that?
Yeah, I remember the guy who shook, certainly. But I think the people who are interested enough in improving their skills through competition have essentially, they're self-motivated enough to become decent and safe shooters from the get-go before they go into competition. I don't think we've ever attracted anybody to the class who shows up and said, you know, I bought this gun yesterday and now I want to shoot IPSC. It's somebody who, they almost always say, I've been shooting for years, but, you know, it's sort of like I shot when I was a kid, but I went away to college and then I'd like to start again, or I've always hunted, you know, my whole life, but I've never really shot pistols very much. So they're almost always people that have a fairly extensive background, either military or sports shooting.
We've even had law enforcement guys show up and take our IPSC classes before.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah.
They have a shooting background already. They just want to direct it to pistol competition.
Yeah, and guys, you know, you hit the, you know, you're talking about something a little bit different than I'm talking about. When they come to you guys, they're interested, they've been shooting, and they're interested in improving their shooting.
Mm-hmm.
Where I was going with my question earlier is, in states like Washington, where they don't require any training to get your concealed carry license, what if you got somebody that has never shot a gun before? All of a sudden they feel like they want to get one and they want to carry it. So they fulfill the Washington state requirements. Now they have zilch background with a firearm, and all of a sudden now they're loading that thing up, sticking it in their holster. Doesn't that make you a little nervous?
Yeah, because I think it would just be like saying, if somebody got a driver's license, I mean, I hate to use the comparison of cars and guns, but it's the one that's, you know, I'll just go ahead and drag it out since everybody does.
Yeah.
You know, how would I feel about giving a driver's license to somebody who had never taken a driver's ed class?
Exactly.
I mean, you know, I would like to think, but of course the flip side of that is we have no constitutional protection of our right to drive a car. You know,
true. True.
I mean, it's a similar issue in that the society is, dependent, you know, the safety of society is dependent on how safely you operate the instrument, you know. But I think if somebody called me and said, you know, I have no experience whatsoever and I'm interested in getting into IPSC, I would say go take an NRA basic pistol class and come back and see us after you've passed. Because although we are instructors on how to shoot, we're expecting the person to already know which end the bullet comes out of and to have a basic understanding of gun, safe gun handling. And, you know, we're not prepared to, it would hold the whole class back to have somebody at that basic of a level.
And right. Well, okay. So I had two comments there on that aspect, or two things to say on that. I'm going to start with the first one that you were talking about, you know, passing a class and whatnot beforehand. At this point, I would venture to guess that any 16-year-old kid could probably go to a gas station with a bottle and fill it up with gasoline, stuff a rag in it, and light it. And, you know, and there's no requirement that anybody knows about how, you know, what gasoline does, or have taken a chemistry class, or, you know, how bombs or explosions work or anything like that. So, I mean, yes, there is a certain amount of danger here, but there's also a certain amount of responsibility that goes along with it. In terms of what Rick was talking about just basic knowledge and whatnot. This has been something that we've kind of struggled with in terms of our IPSC 101 classes, that we've had some people show up to these classes that are what we would kind of really define as below a kind of like a minimum proficiency level. I mean, you almost get the feeling that some of these people have never drawn a gun from a holster before, or never just done a lot of the fundamental things. And we've even talked about before of possibly changing the format of the course, of what we have right now, into literally starting out with the first day of literally just being basic pistol proficiency, of getting them up to speed, of knowing things about, I mean, just the basic stuff, and then progressing them into, you know, the beginning IPSC stuff. We haven't proceeded or moved along with that idea anymore. We've talked about it, but it is something that we've run into of people who have decided to take the IPSC 101 classes, and we've all kind of talked amongst ourselves and said, wow, this guy is, you know, really a beginning shooter. You almost get the feeling that they've not done a whole lot of pistol shooting, and almost to the following along the lines of what you said, is that they literally went out and bought the gun yesterday and decided to, you know, jump in the IPSC 101 class the next day.
Yeah. So Rick, to kind of pick up on what Steve said, your advice to a person like that is go take the NRA basic pistol course first, right?
Yes. Yeah. Or something similar. I mean, we're here in the Seattle area. We've got a couple of shooting schools in the area, independently, you know, operated. They're not under the umbrella of NRA. They're just, you know, they do firearms instruction, tactical type stuff. And they have a number of pistol classes, introductory pistol classes, along with NRA classes that are available locally. And so, you know, I would want somebody to take a class where they learn basic marksmanship, basic gun handling, and then when they not mastered that, but when they have that level of experience under their belt, then they're ready to take on. I mean, even the basic IPSC 101 stuff we teach, from most people's perspective, are advanced techniques.
Yeah.
You know, the draw and shooting while moving and using cover positions, which isn't specific to IPSC, but like shooting around barricades and whatnot. You know, that stuff that's advanced techniques, and that's what we're teaching. As you know, the first day of our IPSC 101 class is more advanced training than a lot of people will ever have. And so,
right.
You know, it's basic to the competition, but it's not basic to gun handling. So the people really have to have, you know, kind of a basic gun handling marksmanship foundation before they can take the class.
Well, since this show's about training, it seems to me that the biggest training need out there is for people to just get the NRA basic pistol stuff down. Don't you guys agree?
Probably, yeah. Yeah, I mean, if everybody took the NRA basic classes, everybody would be a better shooter and everybody would be a safer gun handler. You know,
oh, definitely.
The world would be a better place. So.
Yeah.
But,
yeah, I definitely agree with that. I think it's a very wise idea. You can go back to the whole entire car thing. I mean, which is a nice similarity, but I mean, I think everybody would agree that if you could go out and just get a license and go drive a car, I mean, you'll probably figure it out on your own after a bit, but having taken at least some driving course or whatever would certainly make you a better driver. I think the same thing follows along with the basic NRA pistol class, is that sure, you can go out there and you can figure it out on your own. The other point of that is that while figuring out on your own may take you 5 years, if you go take a class, it may take you 1 month. So you can look at it from the standpoint of just efficiency of time, that you're going to be much better off to go out there. I mean, if you're really that type of a person who wants to learn, wants to become proficient, and wants to become really good, sure, you can go out and become self-taught and figure it out and talk to people and whatnot. But if you go take a class and learn from the experts, your acceleration is going to be much quicker of getting up to speed. And that just means you can learn the more advanced techniques that much faster and that much better.
Yeah. I mean, I think about, you know, since we're on the subject of driving, I've lived in 5 different states, but I've only taken a driver's test where I actually do the driving once, and that was when I first got my license. I've never had to actually take the driving portion of that test since then. But yet, I've taken the shooting training for concealed carry twice in less than 10 years.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think it's interesting in that if you think about how much damage, you know, one person can do with a gun, either through negligence or even, you know, just, you know, wanton hatred or whatever their motivation is, you know, like when there's the unfortunate shooting down in Arizona where, you know, one madman with a high-capacity magazine, you know, injured and killed X number of people. But you think about, every day when I'm walking to work on a sidewalk that's got 100 people on it, anybody in a pickup truck who wanted to could mow down 20 people, you know?
Exactly.
And so we trust that the person who's behind the wheel doesn't have any motivation other than just to get where they want to go safely, you know? And we don't have a mental evaluation of whether the person, you know, is going to drive off the road and crash into, you know, a cafe, you know, or, I mean, it's just, there's this, I think it's interesting that that there's kind of this assumption that somebody that has a gun, owns a gun, is somehow predisposed to being a danger to society. So we have to train them and evaluate them and see if they're going to be a danger or not. Whereas somebody who's in a position, let's say, you know, of getting a driver's license, drives a city bus, I mean, you know, or even just a private, you know, driver's license to drive to work every day or drive to school every day, you know, it's scrutinized in a completely different level. There's not this assumption that, you know, you're going to go off and be a danger to society. It's just an evaluation. You know, can you drive the car? Yeah, okay, here's your license. You know, it's not like, you know, when you're driving, do you ever, you know, fantasize about crashing into crowded rooms? You know, I mean, it's not, there's never this association of having the ability to harm people and the desire to harm people, and which is automatically applied to firearms.
Well, you know, you're exactly right, Rick, because, you know, you think about it, you know, you mentioned it earlier, driving is not a right, it's a privilege, yet for that privilege, we don't really require that anybody do anything except take the driver's ed course and the driving test when they're 16, but yet we all really have a constitutionally protected right to carry a gun, but yet we require in most states everybody to take consistent training.
Hey, Bob, I'm gonna put you on the spot about something here, so I hope this isn't gonna make you too uncomfortable, but listening to one of your previous podcasts, well, let me first state that it sounds like basically that you think that, taking some sort of a, class should be a prerequisite to getting a concealed pistol license or something of that nature. Am I correct in that assumption?
I lean that way. I don't know if I would go all the way to say it needs to be mandatory, but yeah, I'm kind of leaning that way, but go ahead and put me on the spot.
Okay. So where I'm going with this is that you mentioned before in one of your podcasts that it sounded like you were saying that you did not believe that mental evaluations or mental background checks or mental conditions or whatever should even be part of a consideration for getting a concealed pistol license or I should say just even buying a firearm. And I think where we were going with this is that in the case of the guy in Tucson is that he obviously was a nut job, but it sounded like you were saying that you did not believe that the mental evaluation should be a consideration for somebody being able to buy a firearm.
If that's the message you got from it, then I miscommunicated. I'm in favor of some kind of a system to try to prevent the Jared Loughners of the world from legally getting a firearm the way he did. Because, I mean, even though he lied on the form, I guess you could say that he illegally got it. But he was able to lie on the form and get it, and there was no checking up on him. There was no communication between the people that knew he had something wrong with him to the people that were allowing him to purchase a firearm.
Okay, but am I understanding you correctly then that you do think that mental records or mental evaluations or whatever should be then a consideration when they do the next check or the background check or things of that nature?
Absolutely.
Okay.
I support that. I support that. What I'm on the fence about is training. Whether that should be required for someone to carry a firearm, but definitely mentally, yes. I definitely think there should be some form of checks on someone's mental ability, mental health.
Okay, Absolutely. Good. I just want to clear that because it sounded like you were implying before that from a kind of a, I'm trying to think about a, you know, personal privacy issues or whatever, that it seemed like you were possibly suggesting that should not be a consideration for being able to purchase a firearm. And
I know where you're getting that from. I mentioned something about that I would be concerned about a person's medical records being made so public, and someone's mental health is a very private medical condition, and I would be very concerned once you make that publicly accessible by a gun dealer. Once a gun dealer can get on his computer and access your medical records to find out whether or not you have a mental illness, I do think you walk a very thin line there that would need to be very, very tightly controlled if the government were going to require a mental health analysis. Because how do you prevent someone's private medical records from being accessed?
Oh, I definitely agree. I don't think the gun dealer should have access to it, but in my personal opinion, I think that the mental record should be a consideration. And again, this all becomes subjective, but whoever decides to, you know, to flip the switch and let the transaction go through ultimately has that decision process to make or the ability to make that decision. I believe that they should be able to look at a person's medical records or whatnot to decide whether they should approve or reject the sale. But I would agree that I don't think it's up to the gun dealer to even see that information. I mean, from their standpoint, I think what they should be doing, and I think what they would be doing, is calling in and saying, you know, is this transaction approved, yes or no? And if they get no, and it's no because of, you know, criminal background or failure to pass a medical, you know, evaluation or whatever, they don't need to know that. All they get is a no, and that's it.
Yeah, but somebody knows. Somebody, whether it's the government or somebody, whoever is running that check is going to know the reason why. And if it's due to mental illness, now all of a sudden somebody knows somebody else's private medical information. And I've heard the idea floated around in countless podcasts and forums, and the news people are all saying, oh, you know, we should check a person's mental health before we allow them to buy a gun. I'm in favor of that, but my question is, how could you do that without invading someone's privacy?
I don't know if you can.
That's my concern. See, there, that was what I meant on the I know what podcast you're referring to now. I did say that. I said it raises some concerns in my mind because it is a huge invasion of that particular person's privacy. Although, if you look at, you know, the nutbag like Loeffner, who is probably four steps crazier than Charlie Sheen, he shouldn't have been able to get that Glock and do what he did.
Right.
So it's something I struggle with. Rick, what do you think?
Well, I'm in the same boat. I mean, I tend to see the whole thing from the personal responsibility side, in that I don't like the idea of the government kind of forcing regulations and forcing requirements on gun owners. But at the same time, I think conscientious gun owners should be taking steps to see to it that the stuff doesn't have to be forced on us. You know, like I look at things like mandatory training. Okay, I don't think there should be mandatory training, but I think anybody who's a conscientious, responsible gun owner should get training, you know. And so it's the same thing where we're trying to protect society from, you know, the dangers of wackos with guns, but I don't know that treating every gun owner like a wacko is the way to accomplish it. I mean, that's and so I think, you know, if you've got this situation where you're putting people under scrutiny who have essentially volunteered to be scrutinized, in the sense that, okay, I'm going to buy a gun, and so I'm agreeing to allow you to investigate my background, whether it's a criminal background, medical background, or whatever. So the government kind of has you over a barrel in that, because you're right, allowing them to look into it. Then how do you tell them then you have to stop now? You know, you can look
right
at my criminal records, but not my mental records, you know?
Right. I'm uncomfortable with that too. Where do you draw the line and tell them they have to stop?
Yeah. And then of course, well, why do you want them to stop? You know, what do you have to hide? I mean, there's all kinds of, you know, if you're not a wacko, why do you mind if they look? I'm like, well, then you end up selling it to the New York Times, you know, or something. And, you know, it's a slippery slope. I mean, it's a classic slippery slope.
Yeah, well, and since we're on this subject, let me just say this. You know, there's a lot of people that have, I think, correctly assessed the fact that what really needs to happen is people like Jared Loeffner and the guy that did the Virginia Tech shooting, those people need to get the mental help that they deserve. And if they get the help, and this is a whole different subject, doesn't have a whole lot to do with guns, but if they get the help, then we'll reduce a lot of these types of incidents. Because the Constitution nowhere says that you even have to take any training or that you even need a license. It doesn't say that. It says you have an inherent right. The Constitution protects that you have protects your inherent right to keep and bear arms.
Yeah.
So,
but we've taken that though and said, okay, you have a right to keep and bear arms, but then we start stating exclusions. I mean, if you're a convicted criminal, you can't. You know, I mean, and there's a whole entire list of things that go on. Of restrictions, and which I think most people would agree are, you know, reasonable restrictions. I mean, do you think criminals should have the right to keep and bear arms?
My first inclination is to say, no, I don't. But somebody find something in the Constitution that says that.
Well, ideally, they're unarmed while they're incarcerated, right?
Pardon me?
I said, ideally, they're unarmed while they're incarcerated.
Correct.
But, you know, if my choice is, everybody owns a gun or nobody owns a gun, I guess I'd be willing to accept a society in which, because, I mean, the criminals are going to have guns anyway.
Right.
I mean, that's the part of that argument where, I mean, since the criminals are going to have the guns anyway, then the law that takes the gun away from me doesn't help me at all. It doesn't help.
Right.
I don't think it helps society, you know, the larger scope of society either. And so, you know, if you've got the, you're trying to regulate the people who are, again, kind of volunteering to be regulated by abiding by the law. And so,
right.
And the people who are by nature law abiding aren't the people you have to worry about, you know?
Yeah, we all know that. Yeah.
Yeah. And so it's like, you know, it's like whenever I see some story about some, you know, somebody's been arrested and they're being fined and this and that, I said, well, the reason they've been arrested and they're fined is because the government knows where they live. There's somebody who's got a job and a phone, you know, and that's how come the government has been able to, you know, identify them and contact them and put the screws to them. Well, if I don't have an address and I have multiple aliases, then I'm operating outside of the ability of the government to find me, you know.
Yeah.
And so I don't have to have a driver's license. I don't have to have a gun permit. I don't have to pay my taxes. But when you try to do things by the book, you know, have a social security number, have a mailing address, have a job, then the government can find you and they can tax you and they can arrest you and they can, you know, and it's just sort of like you're a much easier mark if you're a law abiding citizen than if you're existing kind of as a quote outlaw unquote, you know, where you're just outside the system where you're not easily identified or easily located.
But what is interesting, though, is that the last two shootings, and I will use the Tucson as one, and what was it, the Virginia Tech as the other, both of those guys went and we'll say, bought firearms through the traditional channels, going to a gun store, right? Obviously, the Loeffner bought his at a gun store, and the Virginia Tech guy, I think he bought his at a gun store also, if I remember correctly.
But. Yeah, and Steve, if I'm not mistaken, Mr. Hassan here in Fort Hood, Texas, when he did that shooting, I think he got his firearm legally as well.
Right, okay. But the thing is, and I can't speak in terms of Hassan, but in terms of the Virginia Tech guy, and legislation was then pushed after this, and that he did have mental records that were in one state but apparently weren't shared with another.
Right.
So he had a mental background problem. In the case of Loeffner, he had a mental background problem.
So did Hassan. Hassan did too.
Okay. So clearly, the people, it seems like, with the mental background problems are the ones who right now are at least attempting to go through the traditional channels of being able to buy firearms. So, you know, I guess kind of my thoughts here is that evidently there's apparently a loophole there. Or a problem there in terms of the mental background record sharing or what exactly is being looked at that isn't being looked at that should have stopped these guys from getting firearms.
Yeah, but that opens up that slippery slope we were talking about 5 minutes ago. You know,
that's very true. Yeah. So, where do they stop? I mean, are they going to say, well, right. Okay, fine, but let's come into your house for a week and evaluate, you know, you and your wife and all that sort of stuff. I mean, it's like, excuse me, you know?
Yeah. No, I think there's two answers to this problem. I think they're very simple. Number one, the people that have mental health issues, let's get them the help they need. Number two, let's let every other citizen in America arm themselves and carry just about anywhere so that the next time some nutbag like Loeffner walks into Safeway, somebody else can have a pistol nearby that isn't having to run from another building and hopefully slow this guy down.
I agree, definitely. So let's take that as a new extension. This is turning into quite the roundtable. We've gone full circle on this, but
well, yeah, we have. We started off as a training discussion, and it's evolving, isn't it?
But this could be training. Okay, so what do you think about obviously, which is not allowed right now, unless you are a my wife has run into this. My wife's a flight attendant, so she gets to deal with this all the time. But basically, it's the people who are allowed to carry firearms while on board an airplane. But at any rate, what do you think about civilians' right? Obviously, you don't have that right now, but civilians' right to carry firearms on airplanes as passengers.
Wow, I never thought about that. Interesting subject. Rick, what do you think?
Well, I think it's one of those deals where, if everybody who had a concealed license could carry on a plane, you'd have, you know, a situation, say, like, 9/11, where it's very unlikely that you could hijack a plane successfully if you had people on board, just like it'd be impossible, you know, for a school shooting or less likely. It's just not an easy environment in which to, you know, do your deeds. But on the other hand, you have, you know, I've read enough stories about people who drop their gun on the ground and it goes off. Well, what if you're in the lavatory on the airplane and you drop your gun and it pokes a hole in the skin of the plane? You know, I don't know that if that's an environment in which, it's the danger of poking hole in the plane outweighs the right to be armed. I mean, I don't know. I guess I'd have to be more knowledgeable on the subject to make a determination.
Well, my initial, yeah, well, that's a good point. You make a good point, Rick. My initial thought to Steve's question is this. Yeah, if you're a concealed carry license holder, by all means, you should be allowed to carry on board the aircraft. Because I'll bet you in the instance you talked about, Rick, people dropping their gun and it goes off, I bet you most of them are probably not concealed carry holders, because most of us who conceal carry are much more responsible than that.
Well, you'd like to think so. I mean, there was a story in our local newspaper. I can't remember if it originated here, of a guy in a lavatory. I mean, in a public restroom. And I can't remember. A lot of people were suspicious that maybe it didn't go down quite the way he described it. But the story, the official story from the person involved, was that he dropped it on the ground and it went off, and it grazed the leg of the person in the stall next door or something. I mean, it's one of those situations where it seems, statistically, it's extremely unlikely that it's going to happen, but the last place I think you'd want it to happen would be in a pressurized airplane at 30,000 feet.
Yeah, but if you watch Mythbusters, you know that you can put holes or bullet holes in airplanes and they don't blow up.
Yeah. Well, exactly. Right? I mean, what do they call it? The explosive decompression is apparently something of a Hollywood myth. But anyway, that being said, being in this pressurized container at close quarters with so many people, I don't know that the way to think that, I mean, the means by which the people are disarmed and whatnot in order to ride on the plane, it's still possible to take a gun on a plane, which frankly kind of surprises me in the post 9/11 world. But you know, I think the idea that anybody who has a CPL should be allowed to carry on the plane, I don't know that that's a bad idea. But, like I said, it's one of those things where I have my own kind of gut feeling about it without really being that knowledgeable about the inherent dangers of bullets passing through airplanes.
When you say it's easy for someone to take a gun on a plane, you mean in checked luggage, right?
Yes, exactly. I mean, yeah. I fly to matches just about every year, and so it's surprisingly easy.
Very easy
to get a gun on a plane. I mean, yeah. you give it to the TSA guy, he looks at it, goes, yeah, that's a gun, you lock it up, and away you go. And so, you traveling with firearms is actually fairly painless, but extending that to actually carrying it into the cabin of the plane, I don't know.
Well, my thoughts on that is that, you know, the federal air marshal program, or at least requirements, are pretty strict before they'll allow anybody to be involved in that. I don't think it's a good idea to just let anybody who's passed a CPL or whatever, who doesn't have the proper, and see, now I'm kind of coming 180, at least in some of the things that Bob has talked about, but.
I knew you were going to do that.
Yeah.
That's why.
Right.
That's why
in a situation like that, because, I mean, there's a lot of potential here for things to go really bad, seriously quick. But in terms of a situation like that, I would think that you would need to pass some sort of, I mean, equal to the air marshal program or whatever, to be able to go and proficiently be able to shoot, because I'm not suggesting that it's the Wild West in the air or anything like that, but, you know, if all of a sudden one person thinks they ID somebody as being a terrorist and gets up and there is an air marshal on board followed by somebody who doesn't know he's an air marshal, I mean, you've all of a sudden have a lot of, you know, I don't know who he is type of a deal. And this this same discussion comes up into, you know, you see two people involved in an argument and you're concealed carry or whatever, and one of them pulls a gun, do you pull your gun and try to do something or not? Well, how do you know that the guy who is pulling a gun is not an undercover, you know, an officer or whatever involved in a drug stakeout or something like that? And all of a sudden now you're shooting, potentially shooting at somebody who is a law enforcement guy. So.
Yeah, that could get really dicey real fast.
Right. Right.
I think I almost heard you say you'd be afraid of the person with a concealed carry license that didn't have any training. Did I almost hear that?
Next subject. In certain situations, I would say yes, but yeah.
Yeah, it is. Well, and good. You know, this is a good discussion, guys. And, you know, this is something that could probably go on for a real long time, and we only have a short amount of time here. But
I'll give it a Jaeger picture.
Yeah, yeah, we need to break out the Jägermeister and the cigars now, guys. So, but this was a good discussion, especially we got into some other topics, but we came back around to the training topic.
Yeah, surprisingly enough, yeah.
So let me give each one of you guys the last word here before we sign off. Rick, in terms of training, what do you, whether it's competition training or CPL training, what do you want to say to listeners?
If you're a gun owner, I mean, I think there's a big difference between people who are shooters and people who are gun owners. And if you're a gun owner, I think you should, whether it's mandated by some government agency or your job or whatever, get at least a minimal amount of training. Locate your local NRA instructor, find a public shooting range. They'll probably have an NRA program there. Take a basic pistol class, just like you take, you know, driver's ed. I mean, it's just basic responsibility. You shouldn't have to wait for the government to force you to do it. If more people did it, you know, there wouldn't be as many gun accidents. There wouldn't be as much heat in the press and whatnot. So be a responsible gun owner and get at least a minimal amount of competent instruction.
Good, good. And Steve?
I don't believe in mandatory training. However, I definitely, from what along the lines of what Rick is saying, I think it's definitely a good idea. From the standpoint of being an enthusiast or just learning, you know, a different skill or more skills, becoming more proficient and everything, I think it's definitely in everybody's best interest, for themselves and, you know, others around them, their family and whatnot, to become as proficient with the firearm as possible. But from a constitutional standpoint, I don't believe that that training should be a requirement to either buying a firearm or having a concealed pistol license.
Okay, fair enough. And I would just like to say that if you're in the state of Washington, get in touch with one of these guys and take their training. Go to Steve's IPSC 101. Or have Rick share some of his NRA stuff with you, because I think you'd be well served by it.
Rick, and Rick does the IDPA stuff too. I mean,
the IDPA safety officer. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah.
So, yeah. Which now that's definitely something I'd like to take. I think I'd like to be since IDPA is more prevalent around here where I live, I'd like to be an IDPA safety officer at one point. I think that's something I would enjoy a lot.
Yeah, it's good. I mean, it's. You know, that's one of the things that, you know, that Steve and I talk about is, you know, the level of involvement that you want to get into shooting, especially the shooting sports. Do you want to stay just as a competitor? Do you want to get involved in the club activities? Do you want to be a range officer or safety officer? You know, at what level do you want to give back to the sport and whatnot? And, yeah, anybody who's a serious shooter, going through the range officer class, either the USPSA range officer class or the IDPA safety officer class, you become a better shooter because the more in-depth knowledge you have about the rules and how the sport works. So it's a benefit to you.
Yeah, so one thing to just inject there, and I'll do the little plug for Power Factor here real quick.
Please do it.
We're planning on actually doing an episode at some point in the future of becoming an IDPA SO or USPSA RO and what the advantages of doing that are. So that's going to be in an upcoming episode, which we haven't filmed yet. But I will say one thing in terms of the RO course, like Rick points out, yes, you're giving back to the sport, but the more you learn about the rule book and the more you understand about the rules, the more you can become a gamer and learn how to actually do things. It's got for the rules and use it to your advantage. So I think, you know, if somebody's really seriously into competition, I hate to be saying this, but it really is beneficial to you to go and take the class of being an RO, because not only do you learn the rules and both sides of it, but you also understand what the rules are and how they apply and how you can use them to your advantage.
Okay, we got 30 seconds left. If somebody's listening to this show for the very first time, give out the name of your show and the website real quick.
Go, Steve.
We always do this back and forth. It's powerfactorshow.com. You can send us email or questions at powerfactorshow@gmail.com.
It's a video podcast, folks, and it's really good. Hey, guys, thanks. It's late at night. Time for me to get rid of the Jägermeister and go to bed.
It's time to switch into tequila.
Tequila, yeah, there we go. I'll talk to you guys later.
All right, Bob.
Bye.
Bye.
Okay, pretty fun discussion, wasn't it? I really enjoyed doing that. Steve and Rick, thanks again. Don't forget to check out their show, powerfactorshow.com. And the reason I carry a gun is because I can't carry a cop. My name is Bob Main. Thanks for listening to another episode of the Handgun World Show. Stay safe. Have a good one.
Well, let's put it this way, Bob. Wherever you want to go with this is fine with me. I mean, if you want to start it out with talking about instruction and then competition instruction and competition.
We could segue into foreign language films at some point.
Yeah. Yeah, let's do that. Let's start with French films.
Yeah, okay,
and
good.
then let's go into some of the Mandarin films.
Like Triple Tap.
Yeah. You know, yeah,
that's a good one. Yeah. Right.
So it's an inside joke that I didn't get.
Well, not so much. No, I mean, it's just, I mean, the double tap, triple tap thing. I mean, most of the people who are in IPSC shooting know when you mention, you know, double tap, followed by all the jokes that follow. Oh, you backfired, which weird because the term backfire in apparently Chinese is how they translated, having an accidental discharge. So they called it a backfire. And we were all like, what is a backfire? But at any rate, a backfire is what they called an accidental discharge. Or what happens when you eat too much chili or something like that.
Yeah. My wife said you must have had too many onions. You're backfiring.
Oh, you backfired.
That was cool. Many thanks again to Rick and Steve. Thank you for what you guys did 5 years ago. And I enjoyed listening to it again. Like I said, the old is forever new. If this podcast helps you, if this helps you in your self-defense decisions, your concealed carry decisions, your general firearms decisions. In other words, if you get a lot out of this, consider, first of all, giving me an iTunes review. A lot of you have done that. It's one of the ways that this show remains available and popular to other listeners. You know, they might be going through iTunes and searching for gun podcasts, so please put a review up there if you use iTunes. Just go to the iTunes feed where you listen to this show, and you should be able to figure out how to do a review. I think if you're using like a smart an iPhone, you have to go to the iTunes feed and then go down to the bottom, and there's probably a link there at the bottom of that page to do that. Or if you're using your computer, you can just open up iTunes and search for Handgun World Podcast and leave me a review. I'd very much appreciate that. Okay, and also, in case you haven't noticed, I try to keep this show free of a tremendous amount of commercials. I'm not taking a break every 10 or 15 minutes and running a commercial. I've always found that that's irritating. There are good shows and podcasts out there and even radio shows out there that do that. And even though the show is really, really good, it's kind of irritating to me. So I try not to do that. So this show is primarily supported by generous listeners like you. Make your Amazon purchases. Hey, by the way, happy Mother's Day to all the mothers out there. Don't forget, this show is coming out on Mother's Day. Don't forget your mom. And if you're listening to this after Mother's Day, I hope you remembered to do nice things for your mama. So make your Amazon purchases using my Amazon affiliate store. Go to handgunworld.com go to the Amazon store page, click that link, do that every time. It's just a couple steps, but you'll support me, and Amazon will pay me a nice fee, and you won't have to spend any extra money because you were going to buy that product anyway, weren't you? If you like to watch good instructional videos, Ben Branham from the Modern Self-Protection Podcast and myself, we have a collection of about 55 password-protected videos at the Shooters Club. That's shootersclubmembers.com. It's only $8 a month or $75 a year. That's another way to support us. Sign up for an annual membership or renew it between now and May 30th, and I'm going to give you a free hat. I'll be sending, for those of you who did it in April, you'll be getting your hats probably somewhere around the third week of May. And it's either a Handgun World podcast hat or a Shooters Club hat. They're pretty cool. You can see them on my accessory store at handgunworld.com. And if you want to make a comment or ask me a question, I love getting voicemails. I've received a lot of voicemails for this podcast. That phone number is 210-646-1727. That's 210-646-1727. Okay, well, I'm cruising in the Handgun World mobile studio, as you probably noticed, and I am almost at my destination, so this is probably a good time to conclude this episode. I'm Bob Main. I carry a gun because I can't carry a cop. Remember, evil does not exist in the holster. It exists in the hearts of men and women, and you need to protect yourself against it. Stay armed. Shoot straight, shoot safe. I'll talk to you next week. Goodbye.